Robin Young, it's here and now. Secretary of State Colin Powell is right now visiting victims of the 16-month-long ethnic bloodbath in the Darfur region of Sudan and is reportedly receiving a raucous welcome. Powell is pressing Sudanese officials to end the conflict that has killed as many as 30,000 people. It's estimated a million people have been left without food or shelter. The crisis erupted when government-backed Arab militias turned on the black African population. And that crisis is separate from the 21-year-long civil war that has ravaged the south of the nation. Jerry Martone is on the line. He's director of the emergency response at the International Rescue Committee in New York. He recently returned from Darfur. And, Jerry, we've heard words like staggering, horrific, yet Sudan's foreign minister said yesterday that there is no malnutrition, no disease, no famine in Darfur.
There's a bit of a denial on the part of diplomats, particularly in Sudan, to sort of recognize the severity of the situation, the scale of the displacements, and the situation at which these refugees, these internal refugees, are finding themselves is staggering.
It is striking.
It is certainly the worst humanitarian crisis in the world right now.
What's the death rate?
The threshold for us is one death per 10,000 people per day. That's when we declare an emergency. We're getting statistics back from our clinics, International Rescue Committee clinics, with death rates as high as 5 people per 10,000 per day. That's 5 times greater than what we could call an emergency.
But what can the United States and visiting Colin Powell possibly do if a government doesn't even admit that there's a problem that they are backing?
He's doing precisely what he should do, as Kofi Annan's visit will as well, which is to bring attention to it. What you need for a terrible situation like this, for a slaughter, for an ethnocide, or whatever you call what's happening in Sudan to happen, is silence. This has been a blind spot in the media. It hasn't attracted the profile it needs to put a stop to it. The government of Sudan will yield to international pressure.
Well, you said whatever word you put to it. Why hasn't the U.S. put the word genocide to it?
It's a word that's applied very carefully because it implies an enormous commitment to intervene because of the genocide conventions. But we have to remember that it was only last month that the international tribunals declared Srebrenica a genocide. That was 9 years ago that happened.
Kofi Annan has suggested that UN peacekeeping troops would be useful in the region, but Colin Powell has said that wouldn't be practical. Your thoughts?
It is right in the Sahara Desert, so the distances are vast. There aren't really roads. There are paths in the sand. Rainy season is approaching. Actually, some of the rains have already begun. And these paths turn into muddy, slippery canals. Airports and airstrips are inadequate to kind of land the sort of vehicles. So I think there's some logistical complications to doing it. That being said, I'll tell you what the refugees in these squalid camps want. They do want peacekeepers. If you ask them, what do you need, they say protection. Even now that we fled our homes, we're continually attacked. They're very pleased to see aid workers because they feel we do confer some protection.
Do you really think that Sudan's officials will stop their Arab militias from this killing?
What is being accused is that the government of Sudan has outsourced their sordid task to these militias. But there are questions. Can they turn them back? Now these Janjaweed militias have gained the psychological fortitude, the military assets, and the economic wealth to keep going. Why would they stop?
Do you really think that pressure on the leaders of Sudan is going to be the answer, if in fact the Janjaweed might not even listen to them?
If they bring enough pressure and military might to bear to stop what's happening, it will in fact work. If they increase the number of people who are monitoring, who are witnessing what happens, it is in fact an effective deterrent.
Jerry Martone, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Jerry Martone, Director of Emergency Response at the International Rescue Committee in New York. Today, the Federal Reserve is expected to end an era of easy money by raising interest rates. Many economists predict Chairman Alan Greenspan and company will raise the federal funds rate by 0.25% in the first of what may be a series of incremental credit tightening increases over the next year. So what does that mean for the economy, for consumers? Greg McBride is an analyst for Bankrate.com, a personal finance website. He joins us on the line. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Robin.
Now, let's review. The federal funds rate is what banks charge each other for overnight loans, correct?
Yes.
That, in turn, affects other interest rates. It has been at 1% for the past 4 years, a 46-year low. Why raise it now?
Well, the campaign of the Fed to cut rates over the past several years was directly tied to the economic slump. And now that the economy has recovered to an extent that it no longer needs that stimulus of low interest rates, it's time for the Fed to take back some of that stimulus that had been provided by low interest rates.
We understand that the interest rates are sort of the brake or the accelerator on the economy. Was there a feeling that inflation was looming or here?
Well, that's certainly one of the risks of keeping interest rates too low for too long, is that inflation could begin to accelerate. And while interest rates are generally seen as the accelerator or the brake on the economy, I think it's important to realize that the Fed is not necessarily putting a brake on the economy at this point by raising rates. They're more likely to just lifting their foot off the gas a little bit. And interest rates have fallen so low that it's going to take a lot of action by the Federal Reserve before those interest rates move significantly higher.
So how will consumers feel either today's results or the effects of today?
The initial feeling may be quite modest. A quarter point move is not going to have a significant impact for most households. However, the message is this, that the winds are changing, and we're entering an environment where interest rates will be rising. The low interest rate environment of the past several years is one that really aided debt repayment. In an environment where interest rates are rising, those efforts for debt repayment become a little bit tougher.
Well, one economist we talked to said an extra 1% of interest could be an extra $100 a year on credit card debt.
Exactly. And that's something that over time, that's where people will feel the effect. It's not necessarily going to impact their monthly payment as much as it impacts how quickly they pay down that balance.
Right. How else is it affecting consumers or the economy?
I think one thing that many households have done over the past several years, we've had very steady real estate appreciation. People are sitting on a lot more home equity than they've had in the past. It's the households that are faced with variable rate debt right now, such as a home equity line of credit, or maybe they have an adjustable rate mortgage that will begin to change in a year or 2 years or 3 years from now. That does present a risk to many households.
What should consumers do, Greg? Is there something immediately somebody should do?
Well, you know, I mean, what this does and what this signifies is the beginning of the end of those ultra-low interest rates. And so you've had this great tailwind the past few years. Now the winds are changing a little bit, and that tailwind is going to become a headwind in years to come. So now's the time to really accelerate that debt repayment if you haven't already done so.
And if everybody knows that this increase is supposed to happen today, what are analysts such as yourself looking for in the report?
More important to what the Fed does today is what the Fed says today. One of the things that the Fed has really driven home is that they intend to move interest rates up in a very measured fashion. So their post-meeting statement will be closely scrutinized for any language that either supports that or indicates that they may have a greater concern about inflation and have to act more aggressively down the road.
Reading Alan Greenspan's Tea Leaves today. Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Greg McBride is an analyst for Bankrate.com, a personal finance website. He joined us on the line from North Palm Beach, Florida. A federal inquiry into shadowy marketing tech tactics by many major pharmaceutical companies is underway after a group of doctors said they were promised financial reward for prescribing certain medications. Reporter Gardner Harris of the New York Times joins us on the line. Gardner, what kind of financial rewards are we talking about?
Well, they can be rather blatant or they can be somewhat subtle, but the blatant ones are simply, you know, very high-value checks, $10,000. There were rumors of checks of up to $100,000 that one company, Shearing Plough, paid to physicians simply to prescribe their drugs.
And how did this exchange happen? Did the company approach the doctor?
They did. One doctor told me that he simply received, unsolicited in the mail, a check made out to him for $10,000. And the letter with the check said that the check was for a consulting arrangement with a physician, and if he would simply turn to Schedule A, which was included with the letter, he would see what all the duties involved with the consulting arrangement would be. He turned the page and found a blank piece of paper with the word Schedule A on top. In other words, he had to do nothing but cash the check. It was clear, though, he said, that what they really wanted out of him was his loyalty to their drugs.
Well, that's the disturbing part of this. Does this mean, in effect, that doctors might be prescribing drugs that patients may not need or may not be the right drug for the patient because of the check?
That is certainly the scary thing that's going on. And it is happening to a surprising degree. I'm afraid to say that it's a worrisome trend in medicine that you may not be able to trust your doctor. There is and has been for a long time a lot of money sloshing around in medicine today going from the pharmaceutical industry to doctors' pockets. Last month, Pfizer agreed to pay $430 million as part of a criminal settlement with prosecutors about the marketing of Neurontin. And among the things that prosecutors charged Pfizer with is paying physicians to listen to pitches on this drug, Neurontin, and that sort of included prescriptions from the doctors to patients that didn't really need the drug.
We've heard for a long time that drug companies wine and dine doctors. They take them to concerts. Now you're telling us about these huge amounts of cash. I'm sure there are doctors who say, well, I have to have a conversation with my drug company. I have to give them feedback about the drugs. I'm sure you've heard from doctors who have legitimate relationships with the drug companies.
Sure. I still, and I think a lot of patients might still have some problems with this. I mean, I talk to drug companies a lot because I report on them. I don't take any money from them, and I think the standard ethics in journalism is that reporters must refuse to take money from everybody, even though, you know, we can all make a good argument that these people oftentimes make horrible mistakes and need advice from folks like us who know better. That is the same argument that physicians make, but physicians sort of insist that, of course, they've got to be paid for their advice. And these payments can take, you know, enormous, they can be quite expensive. You know, the problem with this argument is that physicians are also prescribing to patients, to you, drugs. And the worrisome thing is, are they prescribing these drugs because it's the right drug for you, or are they prescribing these drugs because they're being paid by a particular company? And that's an answer that physicians have a hard time making when they are taking this money.
Gardner Harris is with the New York Times. He's recently written about the federal investigation into marketing tactics by major pharmaceutical companies. Gardner, thank you.
Sure.
Just ahead, journeys in Kurdistan, a nation that exists only in the minds of thousands of Kurds. And later we speak with Ron Reagan about his late father and what the son meant to say as he eulogized his dad. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Saddam Hussein will appear before a special tribunal tomorrow, the first step toward the eventual trial of the former leader. One faction in the country will be watching with particular interest. In 1988, the Kurdish people in northern Iraq were victims of Saddam's chemical and biological attacks. At least 50,000 died. The Kurds have no official land. They're spread out over four countries, and in Iraq, they were often expelled from their homes by followers of Saddam Hussein, who ordered whole Kurdish villages destroyed. Now, emboldened by his overthrow, they've been moving back by the thousands, displacing Iraqis, changing the landscape of the country, and also attempting to take a bigger role in Iraqi government. Who are the Kurds? Writer Christiane Bird, her new book is called A Thousand Revolts, A Thousand Sighs, Journeys in Kurdistan, and we asked her to read a passage from her book.
From the moment I arrived in Kurdistan, I felt as if I had fallen through the back door of the world and into a tragic, magic kingdom, the kind of place where tyrants' castles reigned over mist-filled valleys, beautiful damsels ran away with doomed princes, and 10-foot-tall heroes battled scaly green dragons as good clashed swords with evil. In reality, there was no kingdom, at least not of the type found in fairy tales, but I did find evil as well as good, and castles and valleys, damsels and princes, magic and tragedy.
Author Christiane Bird reading from her new book, A Thousand Sighs, A Thousand Revolts, Journeys in Kurdistan. Christiane traveled throughout the Middle East in 2002 as talk of toppling Saddam Hussein was brewing to find out more about the place and the people playing a key role in Mideast politics. And Christiane joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hello. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. And, we hear Kurdistan in your title, but there really is no Kurdistan on the map.
That's correct. It's both a mythical and a real place. It's mythical in the sense that the Kurds have always dreamed of having their own homeland, and they have hopes of one day having a state of their own. And it's real, of course, because they have lived there for many centuries.
They were a tribal people, split up after World War I.
True. They're a tribal people, but they've always actually been split up, even though there's a lot of talk about them being divided in between four nations now. They've actually always been divided. Mm.
And the four nations now, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria, all are somewhat the same, but all very different. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit about the differences?
Well, it's interesting because there's a lot of coming and going between the Iraqi and the Iranian Kurds, for example, and very little between the Iranian and the Turkish Kurds. And each of the groups has really taken on some of the characteristics of their nation state. For example, a lot of the Kurds in Turkey, they dress Western. There's a lot of quite assimilated and Westernized Kurds in Turkey. This is not so much the case in the former no-fly zone, where most of the Kurds, many of the Kurds still dress traditionally, for example.
In northern Iraq, right.
And Kurdish culture is very similar to Persian culture, so there's really more of a sense of unity in Iran than there is in the other two, three countries where there's more distance between the Kurds and the other people.
In fact, in Turkey, as you write, it was illegal to even say you were a Kurd up until, recently. And of course, we know some of the history in Iraq. Let's focus on the Iraqi Kurds. We know Saddam Hussein first used chemical weapons on them in 1988. More than 5,000 Kurds died after bombings with mustard gas and two kinds of nerve gas. You visited the town of Halabja.
Right. That was an extraordinary, horrific year for the Kurds. 5,000 people died there. 180,000 Kurds disappeared during that period. And one of the things that struck me when I visited Halabja, people said to me, why are you coming now? This happened 15 years ago. Not just me. They said, the world is paying attention to us now. Why didn't you pay attention to us 15 years ago? It was really heartbreaking to talk to some of these people. I would go to a home, for example, and I would meet with maybe 6, 7, 8 widows, all dressed entirely in black, their heads, everything covered in black. And some of them would have little shrines to their husbands that they would still have flowers and candles, perhaps, and a picture. And even though their husband had disappeared 15, 20 years ago, many of them were still hoping that they might come back because they had never actually seen their bodies. They just disappeared. Saddam had taken them away.
What's your sense as Iraq tries to forge a new government? Are the Kurdish people so, psychically wounded, that you're shaking your head no. I was going to say that they'll have a problem becoming a part of this government, or
Actually, it's very interesting. I don't see them as psychically wounded. I mean, of course they are on some level, but they're a tremendously resilient people, and they have a real doggedness to them. I mean, there's this practical side to them, and they would tell me these really awful, awful stories, and then I would express sympathy, and they would kind of shrug. Say, well, this is the life we're
going
on.
What's the saying that I remember one said to you, some fall off the train, some stay?
Right, right. There was one of the first people I met there. He said, life is a train. Some people fall off. Some people climb on. And it had so much resonance because he'd been talking about many people that he had lost through all the fighting of the last 30 years. He'd been involved in the resistance since he was a child, basically. And so he was talking about all the people that had fallen off his train in life, and I was one of the new people that had climbed on, but there were so few that had climbed on compared to all the many that had fallen off.
Right. You've written a very long, very detailed, wonderful book, but I'm going to ask you anyway, could you just in a few seconds maybe even close your eyes and try to, bring back what did it feel and smell and what was it like to be among the Kurds in this Kurdistan?
Well, it's a tremendously beautiful area. There's many, many tall mountains, snow-capped mountains. People very much center their lives around the home, and so I've spent many, many hours sitting on the floor, sharing these huge meals of just platter after platter filled with rice and lamb and vegetable dishes, often surrounded by men. Many times I was in large groups of men who were all wearing turbans, for example, with red and white turbans or black and white turbans, and the women would be in their long, beautiful dresses of many multicolors. They're a tremendously polite and tremendously generous people, and I felt a warmth and welcoming everywhere I went.
Amazing, after all they've been through.
It is amazing.
Christiane Bird, it's a wonderful book, and especially timely now. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Christiane Bird, author of the new book, 1,000 Sighs, 1,000 Revolts, Journeys in Kurdistan. And, you know, the title, where does that come from?
It comes from an old Kurdish poem. It's a poem about the Kurds' history and their constant fight to be masters of their own fate. 1,000 Sighs refers to all the times that they've failed, and 1,000 Revolts refers to their constant revolts against the people that are in power above them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When President Ronald Reagan passed away early this month, another man took the national stage, his youngest son, Ron. Now a contributor to MSNBC, Ron Reagan has been speaking out, comparing his father's brand of conservatism with the conservatives in office today. And Ron Reagan joins us on the line from his home in Seattle. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, first of all, let me ask you, how are you after burying a father?
Okay. I mean, you know, it wasn't something that was entirely unexpected, of course. He was 93 years old, had been suffering from Alzheimer's for, you know, 10 years or so. So, you know, this was inevitable. We all knew it was coming, but it's never easy. There's a sense of finality to it, you know, when the day finally does arrive.
Mm. Well, you know, the week of the unbelievable outpouring of affection for your father and seeing you and your siblings was confusing for a lot of people your age, who came of age when the Reagan family was in the White House. And a lot of people felt that there was, you know, maybe estrangement between you and your sister and your parents. And some people took their cues from you at that time. You know, if Patty or you seemed to indicate there was a problem with Dad, then they had a problem with Dad. And then here you are eulogizing your father. Did something happen between you? Did something change?
No, I don't think so, although, you know, we all get a little bit older and think about things perhaps a little bit differently. I don't think any of his children ever had a problem with him personally. Patty and I disagreed with him politically in a lot of instances. But that's very different. The man that I was talking about when I delivered the eulogy was my father as a man, not as a politician. People, you know, history will judge him as a politician in whatever way it does, and probably in various ways. But I wanted to speak about him as a man. Yeah. And as a man, he was, he was an awfully good man.
He was also, though, there was a perception that he didn't express a lot of his feelings towards his children, at least in public. And you had a very good description, I'm going to steal it and use it,
okay,
of what it's like to grow up with a parent born before the age of Oprah.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that was an element in your dad as well?
Well, yes. And I think people of my age whose fathers were somewhere around my father's age will recognize him in their own fathers. Mm-hmm. These are people who did not grow up, men in particular, who did not grow up thinking that it was the thing to do to bury your soul at the drop of a hat. He was a very private person. He was somewhat reserved. Even his wife, my mother, said that there was a little part of him that was just very hard for even her to reach. And that I think that's a generational thing.
Have you been hearing from Democrats in particular that might be taking some delight in some of the comments that you made in the week after the funeral?
Yes, I've heard from some Democrats, and I've heard not directly, but indirectly from some Republicans, too. I've never made any secret of my feelings for this particular administration that we have now. Long before my father passed away, I was very upfront about what I thought about Mr. Bush as a president, a politician, and this administration. I was amused after a couple of days past the eulogy when people started to call me and say, you know, gee, you really kicked up a lot of dust here. The Republicans are very upset about what you said about George Bush. And I said, well, what did I say about it? I didn't say anything about George Bush. Well, you know, the thing about the religion. And I thought, well, this is very interesting and very telling, because I never mentioned him by name. In fact, I referenced many politicians in a sort of generic way when I talked about those who wear their religion on their sleeve for political advantage. But apparently people who were close to Mr. Bush saw him in that remark, and maybe they're right if the shoe fits.
Well, now, were you really not referring to President Bush when you said at your father's eulogy, let's remind people that your father was a deeply religious man, but he never wore it on his sleeve to gain political advantage? You weren't speaking of...
I can promise you that there was only one person on my mind when I delivered my father's eulogy, and that was my father. I wanted to make a point about his faith, because he was a deeply religious man, and it would have been unfair to him to deliver a eulogy and not mention that. But I also wanted to mention what his faith wasn't in his mind, and that was a tool for political advancement.
Well, some would say that the things that you said about this current administration, that seeing pictures from Abu Ghraib, for instance, make you want to take a shower, that they felt the same way during your father's presidency because of, for instance, the Iran-Contra scandal, and that you're being, you know, a little selective in your choice of presidents to criticize.
Well, my father is no longer president, and when he was, I was unstinting in my criticism of it, particularly in private. Mm-hmm. I didn't do a lot of public criticism because that would have unfairly disadvantaged him.
How tough was that, by the way, to have a different political opinion from your dad and he's president?
Well, it's a little different than most people who have political differences with their parents, of course, because he's actually doing something about his political opinions. But other than that, I don't suppose it's very different at all. I don't really see any hypocrisy in my eulogizing my father while criticizing this administration. They really weren't all that much alike. My father distinguished himself to me by being one of the kindest and most decent people I've ever met.
Well, as you know, I mean, help those who are thinking when you say that, well, what about AIDS? He didn't talk about AIDS, you know. Help.
Listen, none of us are perfect. I mean, you know, really, if all we have to do in life now is look back 20 years and start picking apart a man's political career, you know, so that you can tell his son that he, you know, wasn't as good as his son thinks he was. I mean, listen, I agree with you. Should his administration have been on top of AIDS sooner? Yes. Was Iran-Contra a mistake? Yes. I'm telling you that I knew him as a man, and as a man, he was a very kind man, a gentle man, and a good man, and never wanted to hurt anybody and always wanted to do the best he could for other people. Did he make mistakes? Of course he did. All politicians do. All of us do. But that doesn't negate the other.
A couple last questions. I know you didn't want to speak for your mom's political views, but how is she doing?
She's doing okay. She's a very strong woman, and these will be the toughest weeks and months, I think, coming up. The house is quiet. It's very still now. This is a big change in her life, but I think she will be all right. She's got plenty of friends and, you know, family members who will be helping her out and around, and she's got the issue of embryonic stem cell research, which she is very serious about.
And you, what about you? You're a correspondent, as I said. You're going to continue to be as vocal, continue to speak out against President Bush in this being a presidential election year, or is this just because of, as you said, the moment?
Oh, no, I'll continue to speak out. I have strong opinions about that. If I have an opportunity, I'll shoot my mouth off. I seem to be biologically incapable of shutting up, so, yeah, I'll speak out, sure.
Ronald Reagan, thank you so much.
You bet.
And I am sorry about the loss of your father.
Well, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ron Reagan, a contributor to MSNBC. We spoke to him from his home in Seattle. Still to come, we'll hear from the woman who won a chance to perform with the Boston Pops on the 4th of July. You're listening to Here and Now. Federal prosecutors issued a 56-count indictment against the former treasurer of the city of Philadelphia and 11 others yesterday, alleging that city business was exchanged for payoffs and gifts, creating a shadow government with limited oversight and even less accountability. Well, joining us on the line from Philadelphia is WHYY reporter Brad Linder. Brad, this alleged scheme, centers around Ronald White. Who is he and what is he said to have done?
Ronald White is a prominent Philadelphia attorney and a major fundraiser for Mayor John Street, going back to the mayor's days on city council. Ronald White is said to have pretty much hijacked the city treasury department by offering expensive gifts to Corey Kemp, the city treasurer. And in exchange for these expensive gifts, including $10,000 check, a more than $10,000 deck to add on to Corey Kemp's house, trips to the Super Bowl, trips to the NBA All-Star game, in exchange for these gifts to Kemp, Ron White got hundreds of thousands of dollars in business for himself and for people that he was allied with, people that he'd worked with, including for his girlfriend who ran a printing company.
And as I read, she was apparently not very involved in that printing company, but still got huge deals with the city. A lot of the material in the indictment was from wiretaps. Mayor Street's office was tapped. That's the big story in October. That's how the federal investigation was exposed. Is there any sense that he was involved?
There's a strong sense throughout this 150-page indictment that the mayor was involved, but the prosecutors yesterday, the head of the FBI in Philadelphia and the U.S. attorney who filed the indictment, said that they really couldn't bring it up that far, that Corey Kemp is the highest that they could go with this indictment, and Corey Kemp is who is indicted. But there is language in here that implicates the mayor. For example, Ron White, as a longtime fundraiser for Mayor Street, is said to have perpetrated some of these activities to funnel money back into Mayor Street's campaigns. And in fact, there is a line early on in the indictment where he is having a conversation, presumably over a tapped telephone, with Corey Kemp. And he says, if John Street gets reelected, we're going to continue doing this.
In another place, Kemp, the treasurer, tells White, you got your boy sitting in the treasurer's seat, man. That's what we do, man. Take care of each other. Well, some might say, you know, that could be innocent, you know, city hall talk. Where else were they speaking in ways that could be seen as being criminal?
Well, there are a number of instances. Two of the people who are indicted are the president and vice president of Commerce Bank of Pennsylvania. And allegedly what happened was Commerce offered benefits, bank loans, all sorts of things to Corey Kemp, and in exchange for that, received exclusive contracts with the city of Philadelphia. In what were supposed to be open bid contracts, Commerce Bank received no bid contracts effectively. For example, they were told to get their application in first for extending a $30 million line of credit to the city of Philadelphia for a bond deal. And in fact, several other companies did apply for that, but they were pretty much assured over the phone that they would get the deal as long as they got their information in.
Hmm.
What's most interesting now is perhaps the impact on the city of Philadelphia and the way that the city is governed. Corey Kemp stepped down shortly after this news broke last October. And Mayor John Street says he never directly supervised Corey Kemp. In fact, Corey Kemp reported to the city's finance director, a cabinet-level position, and John Street says he only deals with the cabinet members. He said in no uncertain terms yesterday that he does not take responsibility for Kemp's actions and that an indictment is not proof of guilt. And in fact, if anybody was guilty, if Corey Kemp was guilty, he should be held responsible. John Street shouldn't be held responsible. The finance director shouldn't be responsible. And he's got more important things to do, like working out a difficult budget negotiation with Philadelphia City Council.
Brad Linder, thank you so much.
Thank you.
WHYY reporter Brad Linder. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Robin Young. Meat eaters looking for natural beef coming up. But first, as always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line, leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to tell us how to pronounce your name. Tell us the town you're from. For the second time in 5 days, the USDA is investigating another possible case of mad cow disease. The nation's only confirmed case of mad cow was found in a Holstein in Washington State back in December. Concerns about mad cow have affected some people's buying habits. Here are some voices from the Bow Street Cafe, Bow Street Market in Freeport, Maine, which carries natural beef from a nearby farm.
Hold on a second. Do I have any turkey necks for you?
One more.
I think a lot of the people in Freeport care that it's natural, it's local beef, and it sells amazingly well, almost the same as our regular Western beef does.
Even though it's 35% higher.
Exactly, even though it is a bit more expensive.
I noticed that you ordered the wolf neck beef, and I was curious to know why, and why you're willing to spend extra when you can buy the plain old regular stuff for less.
Well, we like the way it's raised. We also like the flavor. We don't get it too often. It's a treat, and it's good to know the way it's raised.
Wolf Neck Natural Beef Farm is also in Freeport, Maine. Recently, Here Now's Kathy Gunst visited and spoke to the farm's CEO, Eric Jensen.
I guess I want to start by asking you, why should I spend $5 to make a burger with your natural beef when I can just go to the supermarket, get conventional beef, maybe pay a dollar? Why should I pay five times as much?
Our animals are raised basically, for the most part, in the open environment. They're fed 100% vegetarian feed, which, you know, no animal byproducts are ever in their feed. So those are very strict standards and ones that the consumer can rely on.
We're standing here outside of a pen. There are, what, about 30, 40 cows in there? Mm-hmm. What kind of cows are we looking at here?
Well, these are calves, actually, from one of our cooperating farms down in Virginia, and they're an Angus-based calf. And these calves will go to not only this farm, but several other cooperating farms in Maine in what we call our Summer in Maine program. It's kind of like summer camp for cows.
Not a bad deal at all. No. Tell us about that.
Well, my theory is with Maine is that Maine's very good at growing grass and has terrific summers, but very short summers. So, you know, why not work with some farmers down in the south where they can graze a lot longer and it's cheaper for them to raise cows, but bring their calves or their offspring, bring them up to Maine, basically for summer camp, and utilize our grass. And you
so this
know,
is a fresh air fund for cows.
Pretty much, yeah. And then from there, they'll go to one of the several feedlots that we work with for the final phase. And certainly we don't allow downer cows to, you know, that's a law now throughout the United States, which is good, you know. But
this is a new law due to the mad cow outbreak.
Yeah, this is a brand new law as a result of that. And, you know, and maybe that'll change down the road, but we've always had that in our protocols that they are not allowed within our system.
In very pedestrian terms, can you explain what a downer cow is?
It's usually an animal that may have had problems giving birth, you know, to where it can't get up anymore or something. You know, probably 99.9% of the time, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it other than it has had an injury.
What is the difference between natural and organic, and why is this not an organic farm?
Well, years ago, we were considered organic, but as the standards have gone up, it has to be 100% organic feed. And there's just not the availability right now of organic grains to do it cost-effectively.
So, not to be crude, but mad cow has helped you.
Mad cow has helped us and helped people look towards an alternative meat supply. I could never have imagined in less than 3 years that we would be, you know, where we're at today.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Here in Now's Kathy Gunst speaking to Eric Jensen, CEO of Wolf's Neck Natural Beef Farm in Freeport, Maine.
Who's falling in love in a hurry?
Tracy Silva.
A Massachusetts van driver for special needs kids by day will be spending the night of the 4th of July on stage, belting out a song for thousands and millions more watching on TV at the Boston Pops annual 4th of July concert. Tracy Silva beat bank managers, teachers, stay-at-home parents, all told 700 competitors, singing for a spot on stage at the celebration. And before fame just swept her away, we decided to give Tracy Silva a call to say hello. Tracy, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
How are you feeling the day after?
Still kind of feeling like, I mean, a dream.
This was a huge competition held in public space in Boston. People came and watched. There was judges. It was Star Search. How often do you sing? Do you sing professionally?
I sing with a gospel group called Love Divine, and then I sing in my own church, and then I sing. I do community theater also.
Because that was one of the restrictions. Obviously, you couldn't be on a record label.
No.
And be in this competition. Had you, you take lessons, but had you perhaps given up? I mean, 36 is, some would say, past, the Britney Spears phase of one's life. Had you dared to dream that this could happen?
The thing is, when I was younger, I didn't really think about pursuing music. I knew I could sing, but it wasn't until later in life that I really wanted to pursue it, and I wished that I did it younger, but I still was looking forward to things, hoping.
Do you mind giving us just a little taste of how you sing around the house? Maybe one of your gospel favorites.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
As I walked through the door, I sensed his presence, and I knew this was a place where love abounds. For this is the temple, God abides here, and we are standing in his presence on holy ground.
It's beautiful.
I don't know if it came out good or not.
No, it's beautiful. What were you thinking when you were standing on the stage? I mean, think of all that have come before.
I've sat in that audience, and watched, and here I am, standing on it. What an honor.
Well, now, I read that you actually twisted your ankle.
Yes, I did. I twisted my ankle on Friday, and, I tried to ice it and take good care of it. And then when I actually got on stage, I'm walking, and Keith whispers on stage, "You're not even Olympic." I'm like, "I know." I think it was the adrenaline. I was just like walking around on it.
This is Keith Lockhart, by the way, that you just called by his first name. your new dear friend. And do I understand that you twisted your ankle trying to get into some sort of physical shape for performing?
Yes, I was doing Tai Bo. I had kind of got out of touch with it, so I was trying to get back into it, and I won't be into it for a while.
Well, this is one of the biggest performances in the world.
I am just beyond excited about this, because now I don't have to worry about the nervousness of the whole competition, and that's all gone. Now it's just all excitement.
Is it really? I mean, do you hope that someone sees you? Do you hope that there's maybe a record contract out of this? What are your hopes?
Oh, that would be beautiful. That would be wonderful. Everyone hopes that, But if not, I'm still grateful for this whole experience.
Yeah. Well, Tracy Silva, new Boston Idol, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Tracy Silva, who won the chance to perform at this year's annual 4th of July celebration with the Boston Pops, she spoke to us from her home in Taunton, Massachusetts. Well, Wayne Hobbs, a banker from Vergennes, Vermont, placed second to Tracy in Pop Search years ago. He says he ran out of money before he could become a professional singer. Now he will perform with the Pops as well this Friday night. Here he is from last night's competition.
La donna è mobile, qual più mal vento, muta d'accento e di pensiero. Sempre una mobile, leggiadro viso, in pianto, in riso, e menzognero.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Ready,
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.